The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
All right, ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Who's Who in Philly Labor Show, sponsored by Weinemann Pain and Wellness, Serious Doctors for Serious Injuries. We've got a great, great show planned for you today. We've got a phenomenal guest. I want to welcome into the program Brian Fritz, founder of Fritz Biancoli. Brian, how are you, sir?
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. Certainly, we have lots to talk about. First of all, if you would, Brian, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and the firm.
Sure. I am a native of Northeast Philadelphia, born here, raised here, still here. We have offices. The firm has offices in South Philadelphia, Center City, Northeast Philadelphia, as well as South Jersey. We represent the region, as well as throughout the both states. We have a large focus on personal injury, but also we have practices in the criminal defense arena, as well as family custody and immigration. So we really have broadened the practice areas of the firm to really represent the needs of the various neighborhoods that we've grown up in, and that we've come to know that the residents in both states, and in particular Philadelphia, need representation. And we've tried to develop a practice that addresses those needs.
Yeah, and you're a Roman Catholic guy. That's where you went to high school, right?
Well, close, Father Judge.
Wait a second. Hold on. That was me that went the Roman Catholic. How did he get on this program? and the cool, your firm is very comprehensive. You're an extremely experienced attorney. But what I also like is you're very, you're community based. And like you said, you have a focus on personal injury, but you do criminal and various other specialties. But one of the things that you've really focused on is, the issues in the communities. Along with what you normally do, you were heavily involved. You have an office in South Philadelphia, and obviously partner Pat Biancoli, who's a great friend and a great friend of labor. And you have an office in South Philly. So when the safe injection sites hit the fan and were sparked upon us and shoved down our throats almost, you clicked right in the gear there and, represented the community in a lot of different ways. Is that a big part of how you ingrain yourself in what's going on?
Yeah, sure, Joe. I mean, what we have to do as trial attorneys and representing, injured people, we have to be able to place ourselves in the shoes of the injured individual to be not only empathetic, but able to adequately tell a story. So when these community issues come up, it's not, it's not foreign to us to be able to place ourselves into the shoes of other individuals in the safe injection site. We're also part of the community with where our office is located, as well as friends and family in that area. So in terms of the concerns, they were very true to our heart, and that's not uncommon with how we practice as well. For instance, a while back in January, we represented the estate of a worker, a laborer who tragically lost his life in a preventable work accident on the pier that resolved for $10.5 million. And even though that sum seems so large and maybe incomprehensible to people, it really was driven by the fact of this historic lack of safety and how the government entities go about processing bids. So what we did was we spearheaded an effort to actually change how governmental entities actually consider bidders and try to eliminate those with a historic safety record. And maybe that way, Jay Johnson would still be alive. But, more importantly, the tragedy that his family suffered didn't have to be faced by others in the future. So, we always have that focus, and it's very common to us to take that up. So when the safe injection sites came up and there was such a concern, such a lack of input, such lack of consideration, and a fundamental lack of planning on behalf of the city and the folks involved in trying to put that site there. In fact, I submitted 30 pages a 30-page brief to supplement my testimony that went before the city of Philadelphia that didn't get in on this debate one side or the other. What it really did was factually go back and look and examine what happened in Canada and how it wasn't being considered here, and nobody was even thinking about that. It was like one of these snap judgments, put it in, and we'll figure it out later. And that might seem immediately inconsistent with the Jay Johnson example, but it's on all fours, where nobody was considering what the future held and just the potential devastation. So it was very easy for us to commit ourselves to that fight.
And we had, you know, you and I had broadcasts on at both of those issues. And in a sense, you know, obviously I get to, you know, have sort of a front row seat in discussing these issues with you. But you're, you know, the passion that you put into the research for your clients, I assume it's the same principles when you're representing a community. And you know, you're going out there. And I remember the details you had when you talked about the, was it Toronto or
Vancouver. Vancouver. Historically, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you, but Vancouver is the one that has the was where the first safe injection sites in North America were put in, and they've had them the longest. They've been in there since 2003, so it provides a very good storybook, in terms of what you could expect in the future. And also, Joe, if I can add something. The city's paper, where they were saying that there was support for the safe injection site, and their argument they advanced, when you actually looked at the paper, it was relying upon information that was generated from 2004, before the injection sites in Vancouver were even a year old.
Sure.
And they were using that for the proposition that there was statistical support of life-saving stuff, when actually the stats showed that Vancouver had experienced an 1,100% increase in overdose deaths since 2008.
That's incredible. I mean, and by, not to mention, you know, all those situations and, you know, the surrounding community and real estate values, the chances of crime increasing, all those stats that you had were staggering. I remember being in the show with you and thinking to myself, oh my God. But one thing that the community never got and is notice, you know, one day the whole city heard that this thing was going to open the next day. There's a rally that day, the next day it's gone. And so, I know you're passionately committed to that. Let's segue a little bit and to right now. Times are a little crazy. Before we, you know, get into what's going on, tell me a little, you know, how you guys are making it through the quarantine and the current status of the firm now that, you know, we're in a stage where people are going back to work, at least in a limited capacity.
Our practice has actually thrived during the quarantine. So it's actually has for us, it's been better than what we expected. I mean, we all of us had no idea what to expect when this first happened, and everybody was really more or less shaking their boots from a financial perspective as well as a societal perspective as to what the future would hold. You know, I'm happy to report that we actually, since the quarantine began, or actually after April 1st, we've been able to distribute more than $12 million in settlements to our clients. And our criminal practice, likewise, has really seen a surge in representation, and we launched that during the quarantine period. So for us, from a practice standpoint, that has been going, thank God, remarkably well. During that quarantine, we, again, being able to realize from what we do, we were able to realize that, you know, there was a lot of people whose businesses were probably on the brink of failing, in particular restaurateurs, while simultaneously the fear faced and the unknowns faced by the people on the front lines had, you know, was something that was daunting. And we looked at both sides of that equation, and we created a program called Livelihoods to Lives, where we were fortunately, or I was fortunately personally, in a position to purchase meals from struggling restaurants and donating them to the frontline workers, hospitals and police mainly. And that started off with using four restaurants to four hospitals and in this area, South Jersey and Philly mainly. And it grew to over 20 restaurants in the Philly, South Jersey area, as well as Los Angeles, Cleveland, and Boca Raton, Florida. So we were able to provide in excess of 10,000 meals during the 12 weeks that the program was fully operational on that level. And the website is Livelihoods to Lives, as if you would spell it out in a sentence, .com. And we compiled two videos on there that really captured the spirit of the program.
And that's amazing. I mean, having, you know, for somebody whose firm has thrived, you know, and during this pandemic, you know, paying it forward to individuals who have not thrived is really special. I mean, yeah, you know, I was in the nightlife industry, in the restaurant industry, till 2015. And my heart goes out to all my associates, all those workers and the owners and individuals that are really, you know, this, by the way, your charity is timely also, because this thing is, you know, for those people, for so many, this is going to be a struggle into the future. Those who are coming back have made it through, and so many have not, are certainly operating at a limited capacity. So what you've done is, and you've reached in, and I've had this conversation with you, you've reached into your own pocket. You didn't do fundraisers. You've reached into your own pocket and paid for meals from struggling, you know, restaurants to give them to the frontline workers. And so absolutely to be commended. And by the way, it's attracted a lot of, you know, local and national press. So, you know, kudos to Brian Fritz and Fritz and Bianculli for, you know, making this effort, because it's incredibly timely and certainly going to be much needed into the future. Let's talk about what's going on today. You know, we have this quarantine that wasn't enough. You know, that was a, I mean, no one's ever seen anything like it, experienced anything like it. And the longer it lasts, the crazier it gets. It's got into the political arena. It's insane. But having said that, you know, we you know, you had the situation with the murder of George Floyd, one of the great tragedies. And there's absolutely no one on the planet who's got a you know, a cell in their brain that wasn't infuriated about that, and so, but it sparked off a situation that's also unprecedented in our time. While the you know, the COVID-19 pandemic is going on, and so it's, you know, this country has been through a lot. And politically and, you know, nationally, we're polarized. We with the partisan politics is so brutal that, quite frankly, you know, it's no wonder why people don't have faith in politics. And here in Philly, we have, you know, so much going on. And you know, that's sort of the trickle down situation. We've had, of course, the protests, the peaceful protests. We have had some violent protests. And in the city of Philadelphia, one of the issues I've had is the lack of leadership from the top. You know, we have situations with statues now, you know, you have protests. Words like vigilantism are coming. How do you assess all this stuff, Brian?
So here, I mean, there was a lot there, and there's a lot to assess, and let me try to break it down as best I can.
Sure.
I personally feel that with the polarization that we're all sort of experiencing, or sort of that sort of is like wrapping us up is not something that's actually realistic or showing a true nature that the community itself is about. And, you know, going back to Livelihoods to Lives program, what we saw was people of all races coming together on all ends to want to help one another. And through that program, which we really said in our second video, is, you know, we said three things. It was belief in an idea, the spirit of trying, and the power of community, and really focusing on the word unity in that word. And when you see how it's all come together, in my opinion, that is what we experienced through that is the true representation of what Philadelphia is and really what the nation as a whole is. And I think a lot of this other stuff is really, unfortunately, not to say people's positions on certain issues are not valid. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is that some of these things and the way that they're sort of being shown in certain forums is really what's creating the polarization. That's not necessarily what the opinions or what the community and what we each feel towards each other as a whole.
Yeah, and I think you're right there. And you know, you have extreme left who have the you know, a big microphone, and you have situations where you know, the word racism is it's a terrible thing, and certainly Black lives do matter, no question about that. And I can't imagine anybody have known that since the day I was born. But they've gone through, and when you talk about a lot of the situations, you know, like what happened with George Floyd and a series of other things before that, you know, they're absolutely, I mean, that's just not tolerable. And I don't think anybody thinks they are tolerable. However, it's true. And I, you know, the truth of the matter is, I mean, you know, I just my own sense of going through, you know, the city or whatever. I've never, you know, I sense if you didn't know what was going on TV and you could put your mind off of some of the violence that happened, you would not know it for the most part on the street. African-Americans, Caucasians, Hispanics, Asians, across the board. I don't sense, I mean, I've never been, you know, treated nicer by anybody and vice versa. Everybody gets along great. But if you read the newspaper and the media and you see the craziness out there, you're right, Brian. I don't think what we're reading in the paper and what we're seeing on national news is necessarily what's going down, what's happening with regular people in the communities. I completely agree with that. However, here in the city of Philadelphia, if you would, because it's again happening in one of your communities in Philadelphia, let's talk about what's going on with the statues. Elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I think the statues, depending on what side you're sitting on, really have become are symbolic of a greater thing. Yeah. I think from the South Philadelphia perspective, is, you know, is part of a tradition, a longstanding tradition that's really representative of a neighborhood, and that wanting people coming in that don't belong to that community, don't belong to that neighborhood, wanting to come in and tear things down is more or less an affront to their existence. And I think that that's where a lot of the passion is, and unfortunately, it's really getting wrapped up over an inanimate object, the statue. And again, if we go back to the safe injection sites, here we are, another situation where there's a lack of input, lack of a representation of the community or a community voice in these issues, which then make people feel alienated from the process and increase frustration. And I think that, you know, let's go to the broader thing, is to, you know, where we have certain statues nationally or worldwide or whatever that stand for things that people don't agree with, or a period of time that's not necessarily the most honorable, or, you know, depending on what side of the equation you're arguing. However, you know, what I go back to in terms of rationalization is, even if you disagree with things and the fact that they're up, okay, there's a reason why Auschwitz still stands, okay? And it's not necessarily to act as some sort of macabre memorial for the horrific things that those people experienced. What I firmly believe is that there was enough rationale by the people in charge to say that this will stand as a testament to what happened here so that it's not repeated again. And the more we go and just these knee-jerk reactions or snap judgments to be tearing things down, ultimately the question of, okay, what is this solving? I don't think it's being asked enough. And what does it do? It doesn't erase history. And I think in terms of soothing anything, it maybe for whatever passions are at that moment, maybe it fits. I don't know. But at most, it's probably fleeting. And I don't really know what the objective is. And it seems that more and more and more, it goes beyond what the initial discussion was about Confederate statues or this or that. And it seems to be broadening to, you know, sometimes Abraham Lincoln is being called racist, a guy, you know, a man who was assassinated after the Civil War, where he spearheaded a very, you know, troublesome war, challenging war, to the point that it was very bleak at times for the Union. And part of the end result was the elimination and abolition of slavery within the United States.
And what's interesting, you know, I mean, it is, you know, and you see that stuff, and it's infuriating. One thing I want to say, we started talking about safe injection sites, and I mentioned that one day it wasn't, you know, it was a non-issue. Next day, it's, you know, they're given 48 hours or something like that, that you know, they're going to open up. One of the issues with the statues, in my opinion, is the lack of leadership we have in the city of Philadelphia, from the top, from the mayor, just like in the safe injection sites.
Sure.
You know, you know, the next thing you know, he wants to take the statues down, and again, there's no community input. Look, empathy is something I think that needs to happen. Okay, and I think that there's going to be change, and there needs to be change in certain areas, no question about it. Empathy and communication. You know, if there's a statue that is you know, an issue within you know, any community, the African American community, and it's causing pain, and there's a lot going on with that, education, you know, leadership and education from the top, where people would you know, where there's a dialogue and leadership and you know, the people from South Philly can understand the issues with the African American community, our Native American community. If there's a conversation there, and you know, you could understand each other's opinions, and that goes vice versa, of what it represents to both. And if there's issues, you can then make a decision to take it down. Or not take it down, but by just going in there and saying we're taking it down, and now all of a sudden the community's confused, and there's individuals that may not know the history of specific situations, but and now all of a sudden you have an abrasive situation, and if erasing a systemic racism is the issue in some cases, because there's been no education and no communication, you're actually, people that weren't racist before or who hadn't really thought about it are now mad, and it potentially is inflaming situations that, if were handled properly in the first place, well, might have not existed. Instead, you have individuals coming out, hiring security companies. It's a radical movement. One of the other issues down there with the statue that's been a problem is in other cities, protesters who have not been and I support, and I know you support the right to protest, no questions asked. Having said that, those individuals in other cities, they went and tore the statues down themselves. So, you know, the mayor's sitting there crying because a community is coming out to support this situation. However, and then, of course, in the labor community, we're hearing that, that a non-union rigger company is coming out to is coming out to take it down, because of course the union community, I'm sure, wouldn't be interested in doing that, particularly without dialogue and understanding, you know, everybody having a say and understanding each other's sides. So now you have people from the neighborhood down there protecting the statue, and one of the problems is that even if the mayor Now, I know there's a restraining order on that now. He can't do it. But even if the mayor chooses not to do it, in other cities, other people, that you know, the protesters, violent protesters, have taken it down. So when the community comes out there to surround the statue, because they've really been kind of polarized again, the mayor comes out and calls them vigilantes. And now you got a really abrasive situation. I think a big part of this whole thing, and I agree with you, you talk about Auschwitz and how it's an example of history, and the best way for people to not repeat history is to learn it, and so you know the statues can be the same way, no question about it. So having said that, because of the lack of leadership at the top, that things are being handled so ridiculously, and he's actually calling out people in the neighborhood, I think it in some cases makes matters worse in regards, you want to eliminate racism in any types of situations, but you don't communicate properly or educate either the community or the protesters or the African-American community who they the protesters are theoretically representing. And now I think there's a chance to make it worse. What are your thoughts there?
So I think part of it is we have to go back historically for a moment, and not historically in terms of the Civil War or anything. We have to go back historically about the mayor. And the mayor came from South Philly. All right. And over the course of time, that's where he had garnered a lot of support from. And I think there is a feeling of betrayal in the South Philly community. Which makes this, when you say worse, yes, it does, because the feeling is that one of their own is more or less, shoving them off to the side and almost acting in not necessarily their best interest, but contrary to their interest. And not only that, contrary to who he represented himself to be over the course of time. There's things where he led the Columbus Day Parade, or at least marched in it. In honor of that, which would go right by that statue and actually congregate in Marconi Plaza. And this is not, decades ago. This is within recent history. And also, when the stories of the Rizzo statue, how he had lauded that and actually pushed for the Rizzo statue, they now suddenly be so vehemently opposed to it. So I think that the feelings of hypocrisy and betrayal from the leadership actually makes the leadership lose all credibility. And I think that the community itself feels that there's absolutely no one they can count on other than themselves.
That's an interesting point you make there. In many, many, many ways, because our police force I'll admit that there obviously needs to be some changes. Defunding the police, in my opinion, is a ridiculous thought process. Don't bring up and by the way, I think it's a term the media is running with, in at least in this city, but you see it around the country, so it's no joke. But defunding the police would, throw something on my table where reform is, in areas where it's needed. But defunding the police would not only destroy the city, people will be leaving here in epidemic proportions, but it would worsen, things for the African-American community and every community. So, I mean, it's not a viable situation, but, you have violence out there and the mayor doesn't say anything about the violence. And, only the people down at Target. They aren't vigilantes unless somebody tries to get by them. Otherwise, they're just out there outside, creating a presence. So the mayor was calling them vigilantes. Well, they're not going out looking for people who they think vandalize something and trying to take matters in their own hand. They're standing out in front of a facility in their own community and really just showing a presence. Because the police, by the way, have been told to stand down. They're in a bad situation because of the absolute insane individual who killed George Floyd, and at the same time, other African Americans. So they're and even at the statue, the police are you know, they're in a terrible position, and so the community comes out and gets involved. Let me ask you, Brian. Let me ask you a question on something you just said. The community has to take matters into their own hands, and you and I have had this conversation, especially when you're worried about. And by the way, a lot of these protesters, this isn't, in my opinion, this isn't black versus white by any stretch. There's a lot of, you know, this is the protesters movement is a multiracial movement. And I support the ability and the opportunity to protest peacefully. However, you have individual, when they're talking about defunding the police, now you're talking about how much, and I think in New York City, De Blasio wants to take $1 billion, off the police budget. Now, it's a bigger city, obviously, but now you have individuals scared, and they have no idea, gun sales are going through the roof. But my question to you is this, and I've been waiting to ask an attorney this, and I know this is not your particular specialty. I know you have a partner that does criminal law, but let me ask you a question. What the legalities, if you know, people are buying guns like it's left and right, anticipating, if they're not moving out of the city right now, they're buying guns because they're anticipating a defunding of the police potential. What, when you talk about the community, having to support themselves and defend themselves, really, what can a community do, Brian? You know, what can, besides you're going to have a gun in your own house? And I don't know, what happens? You know how people were looting and they were, you know, firebombing places? What happens if somebody's throwing a Molotov cocktail from the middle of the street into your living room? What can you do?
Well, I mean, basically it would be the same, in my opinion, as if somebody was lurking around in your house and you thought they had a gun. If you're in your home, you perceive that deadly force is going to be used against you. You have a right to defend yourself and your family against that deadly force and respond accordingly. So in the event that people do own guns, I think that you touched upon is the reason why. People are going out to buy guns because of the feeling of that they're on their own, that leadership have told the police to stand down and that basically step back and let lawlessness prevail and that they're not protected. And, you know, to circle back about this quest or this rage or whatever it is, to argument to defund police, I don't know and I haven't seen anything to say how that will achieve the reforms or the prevention that that apparently is the spirit behind it. And to switch to, I guess, some of these ideas of community policing, yeah. Well, what are we going to have? The guardian angels, the block captains? I don't know how that's going to work. And again, this is indicative of lack of planning, snap judgments, and I think what the public at large feels is that leadership is just engaging in a quest to be politically popular.
Yeah, political correctness, right.
But to whom? To whom? Are these protesters that are coming into Philadelphia and other cities, are they really from there?
Well, I'll tell you, you make an interesting point, but guess what? Who do I think it's to whom? The media. The media has sided completely with the protesters. You saw what I think. I don't know if you saw the couple that, you know, a bunch of violent protesters. I think it was in Georgia. I'm not exact. What's there?
St. Louis.
That's right. They broke through their gated fence, their gated property, and they were threatening to kill them. They pulled their guns out. They were licensed to carry them. They stood in front of their property, a husband and a wife. And the media absolutely destroyed them. And
yeah, they're trying to. Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about they destroyed them. You know, PR wise. I mean, they were, you know, like they were some kind of vigilantes. They had the right to do it. I believe and agree in the right to protest. I do not, believe in the right to, you know, vote, protest violently. One thing I do agree on is police reform. I want to see, this is a great opportunity, the end game. This is an absolutely great opportunity to get police reform where it's needed, to get criminal justice reform where it's needed. The last thing I want to see is, you know, the dialogue focused on statues, which, by the way, you know, listen, if there's issues with statues, let's put something together and let's address the situation. But let's not cause more, you know, make the situation worse, racism, by going into communities and not having that dialogue. And by the way, defunding the police, because right now the end game seems to be ending, you know, defunding the police and taking statues down. And to me, and don't get me wrong, the message is clear, you know, loud and clear that, you know, police brutality at the levels that have, you know, George Floyd went through and a number of other African Americans, you know, have gone through throughout this country, it's loud and clear that that will not be tolerated. And by the way, like we say, and it's not a question that you know, I mean, I believe it. I'm pro police. I'm pro African American community also. But most of the police that we deal with that are out on the street defending themselves are fantastic human beings. However, the situation is complex and needs to be addressed in a very calculated manner. You got to dissect this thing to make sure that this stops. So that is one thing that needed to be accomplished. I mean, how does a guy like the, you know, whatever that guy, the cop was that killed Floyd, Derek Chauvin, he had 17 or 18 violations before he could actually, I mean, and he was still on out there, you know, policing. I mean, situations like that got to go off the table. What we're going to do is we're going to pay some bills. We're going to go to a break. And when we come back, we're going to kind of segue, you know, back into the law and COVID-19 and what's going on still, like in the personal injury world and in the medical scenario. We have a sponsor of the program, Mark Levithan of Weinemann Pain and Wellness, coming on to give us an update of what's going on in that community, which relates heavily to Brian Fritz's community. So we're going to have more with Brian Fritz after the break.
My friends, this is Joe Krause. You've heard me on Philadelphia radio now for over 20 years, and you know I don't often endorse products or people unless they are real game changers. I want to tell you about Weinemann Pain and Wellness, located in Center City, Philadelphia. And at the end of this short personal endorsement, I want you to consider Weinemann Pain and Wellness. If you are recovering from an injury, if you or a family member has been diagnosed with a disorder that has stopped you in your tracks, or if you're like me, determined to learn about wellness while getting yourself prepared to stay healthy so you can enjoy the blessings of your family. Remember the name of this warm and caring location, Weinemann Pain and Wellness. Why should you consider Weinemann Pain and Wellness? Because they are who you expect them to be.
Weinemann Pain and Wellness, located at 1617 John F. Kennedy Boulevard, Suite 1100, Philadelphia, PA 19103. Call Weinemann Pain and Wellness at 215-988-9503. That's 215-988-9503. Call today.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness. From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody, squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
They just told us right away that we're gonna house you, we're gonna feed you, and every single one of his medical bills is just all taken care of.
They've saved my family from financial ruin. It allowed me and my wife both to focus on the most important thing, which was the health and well-being of our son.
We have phenomenal research, outstanding clinical care, and the generosity of public, which allow us to treat patients regardless of what it takes. And that's what makes St. Jude so magical.
At St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, families never receive a bill for treatment, travel, housing, or food, because the only thing a family should worry about is helping their child live.
Doctors send us the toughest cases to be treated at St. Jude, and our patients come from all over the world.
When we come here, they told me, don't worry, everything's been taken care of.
We could never repay St. Jude for what they've given us.
Because of you.
Gracias a ti.
Because of you.
There is St. Jude.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Who's Who in Philly Labor Show. We're sponsored by Weinemann Pain and Wellness, Serious Doctors for Serious Injuries. Our guest is Brian Fritz, attorney and founder of Fritz B. & Cooley, a fantastic firm in the area, a personal injury firm with additional specialties in criminal law and a number of other areas where they represent the community in a number of different factors and in different situations. Brian, we're going to bring into the program Mark Levithan at Weinemann Pain and Wellness. A big part of what you do, Brian, when you're dealing with personal injury cases is the medical side. And throughout the quarantine, you had mentioned earlier that you guys have thrived because of technology and the ability to operate during the situation, and you've taken everything to a new level. But you can't do that without the medical side. When somebody gets injured, treatment's a big part of it. Compliance is a big part of it. And let me bring in Mark Levithan and not only welcome him into the show, but also let's discuss how things are going on that side. Mark, how are you, sir?
Sure, I'm good, Joe. How's yourself? Hey, Brian, how you doing, buddy?
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Great.
Said that, Mark, what's been going on at Weinemann, during the quarantine and the pandemic, in dealing with the individuals that you deal with, injured workers, individuals who have been injured in personal injury type situations? Been going on there, but also what's really importantly, what's also going on now as we're kind of winding things down?
Sure. Well, in the beginning, when things started to first happen back in, the beginning to middle of March, everybody was really scared to death. All the patients, people were afraid to go out of their houses, rightfully so. So we did treat people, and we did everything as best we could, from social distancing to cleaning to limiting the amount of people coming in, taking people's temperatures, which we're still doing, by the way. We're still social distancing, cleaning everything to CDC guidelines after every patient, taking patients' temperatures, taking our staff's temperatures. So we're still maintaining all that. But it's starting to ease up a little bit. I think people are feeling a little more comfortable psychologically. So people are starting to come back to the practice, and they've been for the past, say, 3-4 weeks in greater numbers, but still social distancing. So it's been working out rather well. And for the people that can't come in, we've been doing telemedicine over the telephone with them.
It's interesting, Mark, because in the legal field, and Brian, you guys, like you had said, you guys have thrived through the pandemic and the quarantine. And Mark mentions, telemedicine. But I've also talked to attorneys that have said that the technology that is in the legal field has made it possible to almost not skip a beat. Has that been helpful for your firm?
Joe, yes. I mean, technology has. And let me step back and say this. We didn't necessarily know what the future held, but we were just committed to just to go get through this swinging. And, we really deployed a strategy that we didn't know, as of April 1 and the beginning of that time, from the close of March 17th through probably the middle of April, we had no idea whether or not things were going to turn out a certain way. But we were just dedicated to the use and implementation of technology, and also realization that other lawyers from the defense side, as well as other people in the insurance industries and everything else, were more or less going to have to justify their existence. That they weren't going to be able to say, hey, we have a 3-month sabbatical and we don't do anything. So what we did was we deployed that use of technology, Zoom, conference calling, DocuSign, all these things. They're now available to us, and we learned on the go. We learned on the fly, rather. And, if this happened 10 years ago, maybe it's a different story. I don't know how we would have adjusted, or a lot of places would have adjusted. But we were fortunate to be able to deploy the technology that was available to us. And we've had we would do mediation, court hearings. We were one of the first ones that actually had a mediation before the end of April by the use of Zoom technology. And we managed to get cases resolved that way.
And Mark, the new norm, that phrase has been thrown around a lot. And so you guys have been not only, treating the patients and doing the telemedicine, but you're also doing depositions. Dr. Reinemann is doing depositions. Tell for the lawyers and in some cases not skipping a beat. Is that and we'll get to the new norm in a second, but tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I have to agree with Brian. I mean, nobody really knew what to do. I mean, there wasn't it's like when you have a child. When a child's hurt, there's not like doesn't come with a manual. There was no manual that came with COVID. So everybody just had to figure it out for themselves and do what they needed to do to the best of their abilities. But yes, we have been doing. Matter of fact, Dr. Weinemann did this week. He's going to do 3 depositions this week. He did 3 depositions last week, and they're all done. A lot of them are, some are coming in, believe it or not, but a lot of them are done by video, by Zoom or different type of electronic type of equipment. And it's funny, I've had conversations with a lot of attorneys, and Brian, I don't know if you've thought about this, but a lot of attorneys, it's made their life a lot easier where they can do this. They don't have to drive into Center City or they don't have to do that. They could do this from the comfort of their own home or a remote office and still accomplish what they need to do, okay, and get that video depth done.
I agree 100%, and I actually think that there's going to be a corresponding issue that develops from this, is that a lot of places that have a huge amount of resources dedicated to rent in commercial buildings were forced, maybe they would have been less likely to adopt this technology other than necessity, forcing them to do it. But I think there's been a growing realization that people actually get a lot done in their homes with technology, and there might be a lack of need for all this commitment to rent and office space, which we may see have a whole different impact on the commercial office setting within places like Philadelphia.
Go ahead, Mark.
I couldn't agree with you more, Brian. I sure would want to be the owner of office buildings right now in Center City, Philadelphia. I think that there's going to be a total change of of, I mean, I don't know if you know, but the numbers, I believe, are about 25% of all office buildings are rented by attorneys in the city of Philadelphia. It's huge. Mm-hmm. So, and I think what's going to happen is all these lawyers that are spending, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a month in rent, okay, they're going to find out, hey, you know what, I could save half of it and give freedom to my employees and have a happier, better working employee, okay? And mm-hmm. I think it's going to suffice that way.
Now, having said that, Mark, it's interesting because I actually thought about that and how, for example, that would, you know, the new norm. Is that part of the new norm? And let me run this scenario by, if I'm a, and we got, I'm sure we got about, what, 5-6 minutes left. But the new norm, it seems like, you know, in the legal field and in that medical related fields, those seem to be the new norms. But how do you do that with new employees? I've heard great things about working remotely and having staffs, and obviously you've had long term staffs and you have great relationships. But how do you do that with new employees? It's kind of hard to hire somebody and then all of a sudden, without having any kind of working relationship, tell them they're working at home from home. Do you foresee sort of like a trial period with new employees and a training period before you let new employees, work remotely, Brian?
I think Mark had mentioned there's no manual. I think that's part of the right. part of the unwritten. That will be we will see. I mean, we don't necessarily have some sort of forecast as to how that's going to play out. I think, you know, the way I would predict, and I think that's implied in your question, Joe, is this little bit of trepidation over any new employee, where the trial period, actually on both sides, for the employee and for the organization, as to whether or not it's going to be a fit. And I think from a culture standpoint, as well as from the organization to evaluate the employee, there's going to have to be, at least at this point, foreseeably, some level of interaction on a more physical presence in the same office setting to see why it's working, and also for an adjustment period to then have the confidence in that employee to work from home, and also likewise for that employee to be familiar enough with the systems and the culture and the who's who, to be able to effectively do their jobs. So I think just to say, give someone saying, hey, we use these programs, and I guess you'll be on a Zoom call at 9 a.m. from your kitchen on Monday, and from here on out, you know. And my background, my undergraduate degree, and not to hog up the last part of this the show, my undergraduate degree was in something called labor industrial relations, which has a huge emphasis on human relations. And part of the concept in terms of an effective organization is one that taps into something called the informal organization, the one of people having a quality of life, some sort of commitment to one another, enjoyment of working with one another. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not that is able to be maintained in some fashion the more we move to a remote sort of setting, and having new employees get acquainted to that so that they feel comfortable and getting to know everybody to be committed to the team. I think that's going to be a little bit of a sort of wait and see approach and how it plays out.
Mark?
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody has different work ethic. Some people are going to adjust to be able to work at home. Some people aren't. Some people, well, if they're working at home, well, I'm going to have lunch with my kids, or, you know what, I'm going to make a personal phone call, I'm going to do this. And I think there is a happy balance. I agree with Brian. I think that, you know, people, happier employees work better. So as long as they can put in their productive time, okay, and you know, work from home, it'll be great. But some employees may have a difficult time with that. Just, you know, I'm at home, I'm gonna watch the soap operas this afternoon. So it depends on, you know, what their schedule is, how they're disciplined. But anybody that's a professional should be able to do it, and and should be able to accomplish themselves very well.
And so before we go, we got about a minute or two. Bri, if you would, tell our listeners real quick what different specialties you handle in the personal injury area in representing your clients. We got about a minute on that.
Sure, thanks, Joe. With regard to personal injury, we represent the catastrophically injured people that we often see that result from construction-related accidents, job site-related accidents, as well as the people that get injured on properties called premises liability cases, as well as auto, where people are injured in car accidents. And one thing that we do that we feel we do better than a lot of other people is the fact that we take a case and we look at it and we say, how do we make it most impactful in terms of an award for the client so that they can get through the rest of their lives? And that's our philosophy and our approach. And that has translated from taking garden variety cases that probably would have resolved for lower values that we put in the energy to it and the thought process and came up with theories and ways. And, you know, for instance, we've turned cases that would have been $4 million into $10 million cases. And that's our approach to the personal injury setting.
Mark, if you would give our listeners a little bit about what Weinerman does, who you guys treat, and also your contact information.
Sure. We're Weinerman Pain and Wellness, and what we do is we handle work-related injuries. Anybody's injured at work, we handle any type of motor vehicle accident or anyone that was injured in a trip or slip and fall, premises liability type cases. And that's what we do. We're specialists at it. I mean, that's exactly all we do.
And your location?
We're located at 1617 JFK Boulevard, Suite 1100. We're One Penn Center, right above Suburban Station, easy access. You can reach us at 215-988-9503. For any of your medical needs, we'd be more than happy to help anyone.
Brian, your firm's contact information real quick.
Sure. It's Fritz and Bean Cooley. We have offices located in South Philadelphia, Center City, Northeast Philadelphia, and South Jersey. We can be reached at 215-458-2222. And the website is www.fbesq.com.
I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to the Who's Who in Philly Labor Show. I want to thank our guests, Brian Fritz and Mark Levithan of our sponsor, Weinerman Pain and Wellness, Cirrus Doctors from Cirrus Injuries. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Everybody, I'm your host, Joe Doherty. We'll talk to you later.